And welcome to Calvary Christian Fellowship. Hope you guys are having a good evening. Yes? Okay, good. You guys are all, this is different already. Okay. You guys know I'm Bo, and I'm one of our student leaders. I'm actually our student overseer here at the church. And it's so fun to be in student ministry. All of our students are so cool. And every one of them has wonderful gifts from God. I mean, I wish you guys could experience just my time with them on a weekly basis, because their vibe is so fun to be around. And like I said, every one of them has just a special gift from God. And some are good counselors, and some are just really good encouragers, and others have more of a preaching kind of gift and things like that. And one of the biggest blessings in ministry is being able to see kind of how God's using these students in different ways to impact the lives of others. And obviously that becomes our joy and crown, is seeing others built up in Christ and used, you know. And I always think of this passage in 1 Timothy chapter 4. It says, and I used to think of this passage when I was 21 years old, starting my first sermon at CCF years ago. Some of you might remember that sermon. Hopefully a lot of you don't remember that sermon. But in 1 Timothy chapter 4, I always used to say this, and I think of this all the time when I'm thinking of the students. It says, let no one despise your youth. And that means, the word despise means to walk around. You know, like to look at a young person and go, I don't need to listen to them. It says, let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, and in purity. And that's my heart for them, is that these students would walk in a way that would be an example to you guys of what walking with Jesus looks like, man. Where if you really want to see what it means to walk with Jesus, you would look at our student ministry and you go, those guys are hardcore. They're radical. They're radical in holiness, seeking the Lord in purity, going after Christ with the way they talk, the way they love, serving the body of Christ. You know, just doing it. Not for any money or nothing, but they just serve. And I love that. And Paul says to Timothy, a young Timothy, till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. And then he tells Timothy, do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of the hands of the elderships. And like I've already reiterated, how beautiful it is when we as leaders and elders of a church get to see people just raised up and they start blooming. And man, it's really cool. And tonight you guys get a really special treat, because this is the first time that Sean Richards is going to share in front of the entire fellowship here. And as you guys know, Sean is Scott's son. So this is a blessing. I mean, a lot of us have known Sean since he was born. Obviously I have, and his son and my son kind of grew up together. And what's really interesting about Sean Richards coming up here is that it kind of is a little bit of a turn of a page in this sense, is because it's actually the second generation, him and Peter Martin, that have been up here to share. That's really the second generation. And I'll give you a little insight into this. Scott's son, Sean, when Scott started CCF back in January of 94, his worship leader was Peter Martin's father. Isn't that cool? And now you have Peter Martin sharing and Sean Richards sharing. I mean, I just find that so weird. You know, I just go, man, what a trip. You know, God, you're so awesome. It's just so cool to see that. And you know, all, like I said, all these kids, all these students have wonderful gifts, and each in their own way. You know, some of them come up here and share. Some of them, though, minister so much down there. It's just beautiful. So continue to pray for our students. But right now, I want to welcome Sean Richards, wherever you are. Can you come on forward, brother? Give him a hand, guys.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Bo, for that introduction. In the youth group, we've been going through the Minor Prophets as a part of our a 9-year plan through the Bible. I don't think we're going to meet that standard, but just getting ourselves a good shove off before we get into the water of the world. But I was given the privilege of going through Micah after previously a few weeks ago, going through it with the junior hires. So for those of you who have your Bibles, I'd love you to turn there with me. You guys have been to the Minor Prophets. It's actually a really cool book, because for those of you who haven't heard of Micah, you've probably heard of Isaiah a lot more frequently. It's one of the longest books of prophecy in the Bible. And he spoke during a time in Israel where things weren't, as you could call it, what would be a good word? Let's just say they wouldn't show it on Cartoon Network, if I could put it plainly. But Micah and Isaiah both were contemporaries of each other, and basically in literary terms that means they hung out, they basically wrote the same stuff, and that makes sense because they were speaking from the same source. But where they were in Israel at the time, you can read it on your own, was in Second Chronicles chapter 27 through 29. It was during the reign of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And I'm sure you guys know Hezekiah was the forerunner to Manasseh, who was one of the cruelest and corrupt kings Israel ever had. And during Micah's reign, or Micah's prophecy rather, he wasn't a king, he witnessed a lot of flip-flopping when it came to the spiritual balance of the nation as a whole. And I think when it comes to the public image of a nation, you know, we as America, we're strong, we're proud, maybe a little bit too much Burger King and In-N-Out, but as far as where we stand in the world, it's, those you saw Captain America 2 recently, we're the many-headed Hydra that have influence over the entire earth. But our people as a soul, that's really something that we need to bring into question here, because when I was reading through this book of prophecy, I saw a lot of parallels when Micah was literally just ripping the people of Israel. So we'll start in verse 1, Micah chapter 1. The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth, meaning there was a lot of Micahs around, just like when Jesus specified himself as Jesus of Nazareth, it'd be no more common to the name today that would be Josh. You know, which Joshua? He's the guy from Nazareth. Well, Micah was from Moresheth. That was a town a little bit more up west near Jerusalem. So he was a man of Judah. And give you guys a little bit more, sorry to bore you with historical context here, but it was around 700, 800 BC. And during this time in Israel, after David's reign, you know, Saul, David, Solomon, Rehoboam, following King Solomon's little scorpion stunt, cracked the kingdom in half. And it was known as the two kingdoms, Israel and Judah. Judah consisted of the tribe of Benjamin and Judah, specifically holding all of the military power. And Israel held the majority of the people, the farmers, you know, the other 4 and 10 tribes of Israel, or 11 if you count Joseph as Manasseh and Ephraim. But, this time in Israel is interesting because he specifies the kings that he witnessed. In Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 1, it mentions Uzziah, but Micah apparently missed that generation because he mentions Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, all kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Now, I'll start with Jotham. Jotham, he was an okay guy. As far as his influence when it came to the people of Israel, it was a time of spiritual, I guess, I wouldn't say flatlining, but the machine wasn't on danger mode. And, if you read 2 Chronicles, you can realize that where Israel was in their history and what they had been dealing with for the past few years, I mean, you guys see the Middle East, and it's already a consistent hot spot, regardless of technology, but the removal of political pressure basically was anyone's free game. If you can grab the land, it was yours. And Jotham had just basically pulled the reins off of his father Uzziah, who was a great military leader in Israel. The problem was, a lot like King Saul, had an ego. And when he went to a place where he really had no business going and offering a sacrifice in God's temple, leprosy broke out on his forehead and he was essentially cast out. And this wasn't the first time this had happened. You guys remember going through my father's studying in Numbers when Miriam was trying to, you know, argue with Moses concerning the power struggle and all that. She became leprous, but because she apologized and turned her life around to the Lord, that's when the leprosy was healed. Uzziah didn't get that luxury because he didn't take that step to say he was sorry about it. You know, it was just, I'm the one who basically gave Israel the glory days since before even King David. You guys are going to pay me my proper respects. I don't care if I'm sick and crippled and have to, you know, stave within, 49 paces between anyone at any given time. So he missed out on that. But his son Jotham, he was an okay guy. And I like what Chuck's insight was on this, listening to his commentary. It was that this pattern that I mentioned earlier concerning the historical and spiritual narrative to the soul of Israel was where one king was really a screw-up, the son got the message. But then when that father got the message and their son grew up in a spiritually strong home, the classic, you know, spoiled American kid saying, well, if this is what my parents have to offer, you know, following the Lord, staying true to his statutes and commandments, walking in prosperity or at least in safety, knowing that I'm not, you know, going to contract diseases doing things that are stupid. I may as well find out what else the world has to offer, and then the prodigal cycle continues. I realize I was wrong, they come back, and then their kids go on saying, man, my dad's a total flop. I better do the exact opposite of what he did, and then they end up following the Lord. Well, that was what was... I hope that's not going to be what I go through, but that's... that's a fine example of where Jotham was, because when he made an effort to be, you know, like it says, doing what was right in the sight of the Lord, Ahaz, not so much. He established this funny real estate move, I'd like to call it, called the high places. And you're going to hear about that coming up in verse 5. The high places were basically kind of a stand back place, you know, measuring up into saying, you know, I kind of got this thing going against you. Where the temple of God was built on the highest mountain, the hill of Jerusalem. They basically took that as a saying, you know, the closer we are to heaven, the closer we are to divinity. So if I can find a mountain higher than the God's temple, that means I'm taller than God, right? Right? Well, you may remember the names of some of these false gods that they made altars to. There was Moloch. Before the technology that we have today to perform abortions, they would allow the child to be born, but culturally, not scientifically, but culturally, if the baby wasn't named, it wasn't considered a complete human being yet. So they had full grounds to just consider it no more than an object. And by worshiping the Lord of Pleasure, Moloch, for the sake of convenience, and continued in your promiscuity, however you pronounce that, your lifestyle, you would heat the brass altar of Moloch, which was holding its arms out like this, till they were red hot, and just drop the newborn infant on top of it. And imagining the screaming gives me nightmares, but I'm told to stand up here anyway. There was Ashtoreth, again, queen of pleasure, worshipped through, I think you can compare it to, in Roman mythology, Aphrodite, temple prostitution, the altars and statues had pornographic attributes, so it was basically what you would call most of our internet access in our culture today. Ashtoreth worship, altars that you would go and interact with the prostitutes, and Baal, I'm sure we all remember that one, Elijah facing down the prophets of Baal. They got into their ravings and rantings and hollerings, praying for rain. They began to cut themselves, and Elijah was just laughing. And it was just basically any other name that would call you aside from God as master over your life, because that's what the name means, Baal. Dagon, worship of self-image. It was worship through binge eating and bulimia. I've seen that happen a lot within close friends of mine. You can see any other given name. I think they were more honest back then about who they were serving because these idols were ugly. I mean, you remember Paul's experience in Ephesus. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. They got into this rave, and half of them didn't even know what they were doing there in the first place. But they just got so riled up into this thing. Diana, it was just a six-breasted altar with, it was a trident and a sword holding out in either ways. And it was based off of the original image of Astaroth. And just I guess, iTunes iOS update. And I'm sure just as stressful. But Ahaz established these high places and basically set up a real estate competition with God's throne. And you could imagine God didn't like that very much. Hezekiah, his son, saw his dad had just basically made himself into a train wreck, did not want to head that type of life, because you can imagine what he died from in excess of all of these things. And Hezekiah created a new state of spiritual revival in Israel. And wherever this led, he was close to God in a way. Whenever a problem was coming up, he was facing the kingdom of Syria, an invasion that we're going to actually be talking about here in a few minutes. And these people were nuts. I mean, Assyria is based off of most horror flicks that you would imagine today. They basically did psychological warfare before it was cool. And I don't think it ever was, they would influence the minds and hearts of people as a weapon of itself, so much so that when the Assyrians would come to the gates of a city, the entire population would commit suicide rather than to be left into the hands of these guys. And I'm sure you guys remember Jonah. Why do you think it was that he would rather die than to know that God was offering a hand of grace to these people? It's because the Ninevites... Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And where that led to was in the captivity of the upper 10 kingdoms, the nation of Israel, not Judah, but Israel. God judged them through Assyria. And just like the prophet Habakkuk was given a revelation by God that Babylon was going to be used to rid the idols from Judah, it was very awkward for him because idolatry was invented in Babylon. You're using idolaters to cleanse our idolatry. And God said, yes. Well, Habakkuk kind of mouthed off and then just said, all right, I don't like that, but you're in charge, so I'll just, don't hit me. Hezekiah, Ahaz, Jotham, a lot of flip-flopping when it came to the spiritual heart and mind of Israel. And Micah had finally been called to the front lines to say right before the birth of Manasseh, who was the son of Hezekiah. And the funny thing was, Hezekiah even pleaded with God saying, extend my life so that my son doesn't inherit my throne soon. You could imagine he took a hint. He made Ahaz look like a featherweight with what he did to Israel, persecuted, murdered the prophets. It's completely brought back and closed the doors to the temple. Everything that was done by these kings, it was, for better or for worse, all the furthering of God's plan. Because regardless of how horrifying this all seems, that a nation as horrifying as Assyria, who worshiped their own idols, which is why they tore down the high places of Jerusalem, the barbaric practices of these people, everything that they had to offer was just pain, suffering, death, and the world. And God said, who do you think you've been siding with for the past 50 years? All of these kings and all of these reigns, I mean, these guys had long lives and productive lives. I mean, you guys have probably heard the story that in the region of Galilee, it's easier to grow 10 pounds of fruit than it is to raise one child. I mean, this God had given them a promised land and saying it was flowing with milk and honey. It wasn't an exaggeration. But just like with Sodom and Gomorrah, the reason why they had gotten so corrupt is they had too much free time. And the idle hands, the devil's workshop. And Micah begins his prophecy concerning not only his home country in Jerusalem, in Judah, but in Samaria as well, the capital of the northern 10 tribes. You guys remember the Samaritans, that's what they're referring to. Because when Assyrians would take over a nation, they would do this dispersion technique that would demoralize them. Like if Assyria, which isn't an active country like it is today, but use your imagination, if they were to take over, like, you know, it was going to go all Red Dawn on here, and I'd be Charlie Sheen, and you guys would be one of the other guys, and we'd have to fight for our lives against an invading force in the United States, something we've never had to deal with because of our strong military. All of the citizens, they wouldn't be rounded up into communist work camps to be brainwashed. They'd literally be sent, like, we'll take some of you guys in this town, send you off to another far-off region, like, say, Japan. And I could probably translate, but another of you would go to India, and it would just basically demoralize the people to the point where they would just be immersed in these cultures, and they'd have no reason to come back to their land again. So Samaritans were Jews in a sense, but not so sensical, because the native language of Assyria was Aramaic. What language did Jesus speak when he was in Israel? That was the founding culture, because that was all that was left after Assyria had taken everything. Babylon took out captives, but the majority of the population were just little seed sprouts that Assyria planted to say, this is your culture now, this is who we are, and if you don't like it, then you can join your friends and family on fish hooks and see on the guy who has a loose foot on the gas pedal. And that's literally what they did. When they dragged Manasseh off when Assyria invaded, they put hooks in his mouth, tongue, eyes, ears, every single orifice possible. And I'm sure, just like, you know, I won't name any names, but to have a little bit of fun, if someone's in the back seat without a seat belt, you want to see them learn why we wear those things. Compare that also to the struggles of a fish being caught. I don't know what a fish goes through, but it doesn't look comfortable when they have to pull the thing out of the stomach. Life was cheap to them. That's the point. So the prophecy begins. Hear, all you peoples, listen, O earth, and all that is in it. Pretty broad audience here. Let the Lord be a witness against you. I would not like to be in that courtroom. The Lord from his holy temple, for behold, the Lord is coming out of his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will split like wax before the fire, like waters poured down a steep place. All this for the transgression of Jacob, and all for the sins of the house of Israel. I get a funny image in my head when I hear these words, just basically when I'm sure a lot of you guys remember me when I was really young. I was a very adventurous little guy. And when I would get the opportunity of my parents foolishly lengthening the leash, so to speak, I would take advantage of every single centimeter they gave to me. And I learned the hard way, and that's why I'm standing up here, because I learned. But the one thing that my dad had basically ingrained into my mind to let me know that the leash is coming back, and unless you want a ring neck through the process, stop squirming, was, don't make me come down there. You get it. All my dad has to do is just invite the possibility of him having to make a personal appearance to my shenanigans. Well, God's saying, I'm coming, and it's not a threat. Now, my dad's a big guy, especially when I was a little smaller, but the description I'm getting here, all your high places, all of your exaltations, do you think you can compete with me? You ever seen candle wax after it's been left out for an hour? That's you. I'm not competing with that. I do not want to be in that courtroom. So, fair question, I guess. What did I do wrong? What's the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? Basically, Micah's having a one-sided conversation with the people of Israel, knowing that they're going to ask, I didn't do anything wrong, really. Really? You guys seen what your lives are like Tuesday through Friday? Just because you come to temple on Sabbath and you guys take that extra day off anyway doesn't mean you guys are living lives that honor God. Because as I recall, a life consists more than 1/7 of it. And God is saying to his people through Micah, what is the transgression? What did you do wrong? Look at your capital. America's a great place. Yeah, look who we're sitting in office. It's not really sending a good message. And granted, I'm not here to make a political statement, but we are represented by those people as an international basis. And Putin's laughing right now in Ukraine. I don't think we're that intimidating with a guy who's not Ronald Reagan. So, the representation of who is standing for your country. Is it the people? Is it the leaders? Is it the church? No. You guys are literally living in this, basically it's if the United States was cracked in half and we have Washington, D.C. on one side and what's our side of the country? Las Vegas. Oh, that makes me happy. What is your transgression? Look at your capital. And then Judah is saying, hey, we have the temple. We have your temple, God. What did we do wrong? We don't have any high places. You guys think you're getting away with something? You didn't really have to say much. You just said, your capitals speak for themselves. I liked in the Left Behind books where they just totally made, it was a side comment, but it just set the entire mood. That when the Holy Spirit's restraining force of evil left this world, that even a place that was centered around Christian refugees like Israel had a, well, it wasn't a happy place to be for children. So what is the judgment? What is God going to do when he comes down? Therefore, I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the field, places for planting a vineyard. I don't know much about grapes, but I think you need some pretty flat territory. And if you started out with something like Las Vegas, this isn't going to be pretty. I will pour down her stones into the valley, and I will uncover her foundations. All her carved images shall be beaten to pieces. All her pay as a harlot shall be burned with fire, with the fire. All her idols I will lay desolate, for she gathered it from the pay of a harlot, and they shall return to the pay of a harlot. It's kind of interesting because in the book of Ezekiel, you see this a lot. Actually, even more directly was in the book of Hosea. We remember that another minor prophet who spoke during the time of Isaiah and Micah, he made a spiritual allegory compared to his life in marrying a girl who had a very promiscuous attitude, and she sold herself as a prostitute while they were still married. And God said basically through that relationship, it's how Israel is being to me. Because I'm sure you guys have read the epistle of 1 John, the last verse in the book, all about love, all about knowing, assurance of your salvation. What's the last thing he left the church of Ephesus with after dispersing it through the entire Christian congregation of Asia Minor? Keep yourself from idols, the one thing that'll keep you from living a life that loves and seeks after God. Israel was basically becoming idolatry central, and God's saying, that's the thing I'm tired with. That's the thing I'm tired of competing with. You guys, Isaiah made this comparison. He said, you guys take a block of wood, cut it in half, use the wood to cook your dinner, and then take the other half of your wood, make a face out of it and say, thank you for the food, Lord. And Isaiah is saying, you just cooked your meal with half your God. Does that seem odd to you? And you could imagine God's perspective on this. He's supposed to be the spiritual husband of Israel. And his wife is making an imaginary friend and cheating on him. And now, just taking that at first glance, I'm confused. And I'm not even involved. But we as human beings, right? What was the first thing that we did wrong when it came to making a decision on our own? When the enemy, the serpent came to Eve and offered her another way, something other than what God had planned for her life, something created through her means, something that she could create on her own. And I'm not singling out the female party in here. We were just as stupid, we're actually probably more stupid because we didn't even argue with it. But the point is, we as human beings, the first sin was choosing something over God, not taking his word for it. When he says, don't look at these images, I have something better for you in mind, our first instinct is saying, but it looks so pretty. It's so readily available. It feels good now. Don't starve or binge and purge. I want you to enjoy the food that I have laid out for you, but in moderation. A friend of mine, I had just recently created a Facebook account. She made a, I don't know the terms for these things, I'm sorry, but a poster was pasted on where I would check in the first place, and it said, the number one way to lose weight, 5 steps of stop eating so much junk. It's that simple. And God said, don't eat bugs. Don't eat things that haven't been properly bled. Don't eat pork. There's no telling what's in that. And the reason he was saying this wasn't to take away the wonderful joys of a BLT. I enjoyed Genghis Grill for lunch here, and you could imagine what half my bowl was filled with. But that's because we learned how to cook it. Israel didn't have thermostats back then. Probably didn't even know what mercury was. And the point was, it wasn't that they were Neanderthals. They knew probably more than we know today. They made more use out of resources anyway. But where Israel was at the time was totally taking what God had said was good and taking it into their own hands, making an image not like the perfect God, but like the imperfect man. Not like the incorruptible God, but the incorruptible man, Romans 1. But Micah, after seeing this, obviously, he's not happy about the process. I mean, he's from Judah. I mean, if an American had to stand up and say, you guys, we're all going to be overrun by China. And this is literally a word from God saying, this is not only going to be fast, it's going to be brutal and pretty, and it's going to make the movies look like a silent film. And Micah's reaction to all of this, considering the irony of everything that they've invested into their lives, selling themselves out for something not worth what it was originally. He says, therefore, verse 8, purple lights, therefore, I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make wailing like the jackals and mourning like the ostriches. You know, you guys know what ostriches do when they freak out, right? They shove their heads in the dirt. And I'm sure if you guys read the book of Job or seen any documentaries of the social life of Israel, they're very dramatic people. You can see, like, the wagging of their heads. I mean, one of the funniest things I probably had ever seen concerning that topic was watching them sell stuff. And that's not a Jewish stereotype. I'm not kidding. They, at the sheep market, they will get so emotionally involved into getting a better deal for what their price is. And, you know, when they deal, they strike hands. But, you know, in the process in between, you think someone's going to pull a gun on each other. I mean, it's all in Aramaic, so you can't understand what's going on. And you just know the tension is scary. And everything about their lives, just emotional. I mean, you give me that. Those grapes are soiled. I mean, I would raise those on my own vineyard. I mean, actually, I recently hired a miniature painting company to make a model of the second coming of Jesus Christ, but my one mistake was I forgot they're Mormons. And let's just say I started this process last November, and we're still trying to get a sane deal on the price. Anyway, it's very emotionally involved people. But where was I going with that? The people of Israel were very emotionally invested when they would look at someone with disdain, they'd hiss. They'd wag their heads. And you remember when Jesus was on the cross, they mocked him in those ways. But I mean, it wasn't just like a... I don't want to throw the microphone off, but they just let Shakespearean Elizabethan era. It was, you know, all the John Wayne movies. Whenever a woman's acting, she always looks shocked. And whenever the guy's acting, he always looks like he's thinking. Those probably have correlation somewhere. But wait for it. None of you got it. Okay. Micah's not kidding when you would do this, because when you'd go into mourning over something, you'd throw dust on your head, throw dust in the air. You'd wear uncomfortable and baggy clothing, sackcloth. You'd make an outward expression of the pain that you feel inside in the most promiscuous way possible. I mean, classic teenage drama. But probably 50-year-old men, which makes this weird, but it has merit, because the things that were going to happen to Samaria, this was actually a direct prophecy when he said, I will uncover your foundations, because when Samaria was burned to the ground, it was actually such an intense heat and fire, and it was done so quickly and brutally that literally the rock foundation in which the city was set up on the hill can be seen today. And I mean, in any modernization, you can tell that wherever there's a stable piece of land, a house is going to be built on top of it. But if you look at pictures of where Samaria was today, you can see it's not much use more than just some fruit plains. And it looks like fields down by where my grandma lives, just flat. It wasn't held back. No details were spared at any expense. God was serious when he said, I'm willing to go to any grounds if it means to take this out of your life. Does that mean God doesn't want them to have any fun? Does it mean he wants these things out of your life because I'm the only one, by golly, and you're going to like it? In a way, yes. Because the fun that they were having always has a price in the end. I mean, I can go into direct references, but I'll make it a little more vague so you guys can understand. I won't say Warhammer 40K. I did. But the path of corruption, in any of the video games that I play, it gets you really nice perks right at the moment, like an instant revival for all of your soldiers in this video game I play. Immunity to damage that would cause you problems in the moment. Getting you through tough situations that in otherwise you would need a lot more time to get through. And, you know, the path of corruption, it's fun till the last level. The whole reason you're playing the game in its entirety, the one thing that you have to give up to get these corrupt benefits is the one thing that'll benefit you against the final boss. And that is, by any standard that a computer game could give, exactly what the enemy wants for each and every one of your lives. He wants to take away the one thing that will define your calling, even if it means having to give you everything you want in the moment, as long as it's not that one thing. Because we're fighting demons, not tyrannids. You know, you're fighting hordes, everything seems overwhelming. You'll survive. It may take a little longer. You may have to give it one or two more tries than normal. Everything seems like it's going to be a disaster. I can speak for this from experience, those of you who know. But morning rises. I mean, you read Psalm 63, and literally it's a three-course rant by David, where he just says, God, in you alone whom I trust, you are my rock and my salvation, I shall not be greatly moved. And then he literally just goes into a whole spiel saying, these corrupt men who are always trying to seek after my life, they're going to be utterly destroyed. And he just lets loose of everything that he's feeling, pouring out his heart before God. And then after a slight pause, he just goes back into where he is before God. And instead of saying, I shall not be greatly moved, he said, I shall never be moved. The funny thing is, trial oftentimes gets you into a better place than where you were before, rather than just going through life through lips and daisies. That's oftentimes why Christians face the harder trials. Because what does Proverbs say? When a righteous man falls, he falls seven times, but he stands up again. When a wicked man falls, it's not pretty. Israel was walking the path of corruption, and God loved them too much to let them give up the one thing he had called them for. And I think that was a fairly big calling, guaranteeing the salvation and eternal life of everyone on the planet. Hello? You think he'd want to take a little priority with his people? I'm thankful that he did. Because after this lesson, Israel never touched an idol again. I mean, you look at Israel today, they don't have Yahweh, but they don't have anyone else either. They're just like staunch atheists, or they're messianic, or they're orthodox. That's it. They learned their lesson. And here's the most encouraging thing, is that in Revelation chapter 3, Jesus, when speaking to the churches, said to the church in Thyatira, where he literally said, you guys will no longer be considered my people, even to the point of having to go through the great tribulation if you don't turn this around. You guys don't see that this is going to ruin you guys. Those of you who know, Thyatira is a church that was sexually corrupt. And they were saying, you tolerate this. You allow this woman Jezebel. You eat things sacrificed to idols, and you let these things into your life that are literally rotting you from the inside out and separating you from me. You allow idols, eat things sacrificed to idols. I'm not going to be able to use you. But you turn yourself around. There are even those in Thyatira who will be clothed in white, for they are worthy. Then there's the church in Laodicea, and they had just basically allowed their Christian life to become stagnant, and Jesus had nothing good to say about them. Even Thyatira, the most corrupt of all the churches, still had people who were called according to his plan. And even in that age in the church history, dualism there, they had people who were just humble servants of God. But Laodicea just left their Christian life be stagnant. Oh yeah, I accepted Jesus, but I can live how I want. I wish you were hot or cold. If you were cold against me, I could at least speak to you. If you were hot, I could definitely use you. But because you're lukewarm, you say, I have need of nothing. You're saying, I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth. I'm going to reject you. But here's the most encouraging words. He said, those that I love, I rebuke and chasten. The reason why Israel was being corrected so harshly was because God loved them too much to let them get by with a free pass. The reason why we as Christians never seem to get away with anything is because God loves us too much for us to let go with a long leash. We can get into that in a little bit, but Micah has reason to take this so personally, because in verse 9 it says, for her wounds are incurable, for it has come to Judah, it has come to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem. This is a personal issue. And I'm sure I'm going to get a 25% honesty rate, but for those of you who've seen the show Walking Dead, what's the one thing that you don't want to happen to you more than anything else? Is to get bit. Okay, we got one honest person. I couldn't keep track of that one, but when you'd get bit by one of these walkers, they never used the term zombies in the show. I don't recommend the show for those of you who have sensitive stomachs or, you know, pure hearts and minds. I just got to be super spiritual, but you basically had a matter of hours before a fever would set in and all your muscles would begin to shut down. And because the zombie apocalypse had happened, no one has any access to medicine or doctors. Even after the first season, spoiler alert, they find out that the only station that could have developed a cure ended up blowing itself up to preserve all of the other stuff that they had locked away inside. Well, the only way to get rid of an infected wound beyond any recollection is amputation, even if it means something important. Jesus mentioned this in one of his parables. He said, well, it wasn't a parable, it was just a lesson, but he said, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It's more profitable for you to enter life maimed. And I mean, these were farmers. They used their arms for a lot of things, but he said it's more profitable for you to gain heaven and lose everything else in this life. I mean, the sacrifices I've had to make to walk in purity, I know there's some things that I can't handle. And I've had to remove them from my life, even at the cost of a few friendships. But it was worth it to me, because just like in cold water, it's extremely uncomfortable until you get your head wet. And the process in between is not very fun. It's probably why cold showers are so immediate. But this is where we start to see a little bit more of the attitude that this message has gone, because there's a plus and a minus to this. I was talking to Bo earlier today, and he told us that when you're counseling people and you seem to be saying the same thing over and over, you're probably doing it right, because there's only one message that they need to hear, and it's probably the first that God laid on your heart. Well, Micah was not the first person to be telling all these things. Like I said, he was a contemporary to Isaiah. Micah is basically a Reader's Digest condensed version of the entire book of Isaiah. So you want to save yourself all the longest book in the Bible concerning prophecy, you can just read Micah and basically get the same thing out of it, a guy who just went right to the point. But this wasn't the first time that Israel had heard all of these things. Isaiah had been preaching for over 50 years. He'd been speaking from the Holy Spirit, had been sending this message again and again. Micah had been prophesying this for a long time, and he's only got 7 chapters. You could imagine this was getting to be almost a joke, to have to keep reminding these people, if Syria is coming, if you guys don't turn around, God's going to have to come. You've crossed that line. The Syria is coming. If you guys turn around now, God won't have to judge all of you. Guys, the more of you that follow into this path, the more that God's going to reject. You keep hardening your heart like Pharaoh, the more that God's just going to give up on you. Guys. And he literally gets to the point where this has become a joke. And I think that's very sad. Because no matter how many times he said to the people of Israel, they weren't listening anyway. The end of chapter 3, he gets into the point where he's addressing the priesthood, the people, and the leaders, which I'll be going over with the youth in the upcoming weeks. And everything that he had been going over, it was all an individual effort, just as much as a majority. The parents had responsibility over the child, just like they had the right to make their own right or wrong choices, and they were all individually responsible. But everything that they had done, all they had said to them was saying, prophesy to us of wine and strong drink. We don't want to hear about God's judgment, that God asks us to live holy lives. Be holy like I am holy. I don't want to hear that. How about, I will never leave you, never forsake you? How about verses out of context? How about only encouraging passages? How about we only read the parts of the Bible that make us feel good? If that's the case, then I've been doing a terrible job tonight. It had become a joke to him, and he starts to make puns. We don't get it in our modern-day English, but in the original Hebrew, he starts to use plays on words, like repeating the same word over. And it's kind of morbid, too. Basically, he's the equivalent to these things he's about to rant off on. It's just like, you're all going to die. Care for some apple pie? That kind of thing. Tell it not in Gath. Gath was the capital of the Philistines. I don't need to go much on a history on them. Weep not at all. Gath in Hebrew means weep town. So literally saying, weep not in weep town. Place where you're going to cry, don't just go ahead and cry. In Beth Ephrath, roll yourself in the dust. Beth Ephrath means dust bowl. Very morbid. Pass by in naked shame, O you inhabitant of Saphir. Saphir means beauty. Inhabitant of Zanin does not go out. Zanin means marching. Don't go out in the place where you're supposed to march. Beth Azel mourns. You guys are starting to catch on. Its place to stand is taken away from you. Beth Azel was also a fortress city. Any military strength is going to be useless at this point. For the inhabitant of Maroth pined for good. Maroth means desire. But disaster came down from the Lord. Yes. Two sources confirm. to the gate of Jerusalem, O inhabitant of Lachish. Lachish means horse town. Harness the chariot to the swift steeds. Now this is interesting. She was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, for the transgressions of Israel were found in you. Lachish was a military city, and the reason why Judah was judged a couple decades after Israel was, after they were taken away by Assyria, you guys should read it sometime, Assyria almost got to Jerusalem, but when they got to the city gates in Isaiah 37, I think it was, the angel of the Lord, which a majority of biblical scholars can confirm is the pre-incarnated form of Jesus. It was the same guy who appeared to Joshua when he bowed before his feet, and the angel of the Lord told him to remove the shoes from your feet, for the ground which you stand is holy. The same thing that the burning bush said to Moses when he introduced himself as I am. Just a little context to where we're going for in that. But the angel of the Lord personally defended the gate of Jerusalem, in that in one night, 185,000 Assyrian soldiers were slaughtered. That's pretty cool. It wasn't time for them to go yet, because God wasn't going to, even though he knew the end from the beginning, God wasn't going to judge them until it was time. And just like for both of these kingdoms, he gave them every single chance possible to turn around, but they didn't take it. And that's the funny thing about God, is that even when he was speaking through Jeremiah, Isaiah even, he just said, Lord, who has believed our report? And God just said, tell him anyway. I know that they're not listening. I know each and every one of their hearts is going to reject this message outright, but I will not be unfair. I will give them every single chance, even knowing that they will reject me. Sound familiar? It's the hardest thing for me to see a lot of my friends, no matter how many times I share with them, no matter how many times. Most of them have grown up in church and they've walked away. No matter how many times I've prayed for them and I see them continue to destroy their lives, it just breaks my heart to see that no matter what, they still say no. Even knowing, I'm serious, I've had a friend tell me, I know heaven is real, I know God is real, I know everything you're saying is true, but I don't want it. And God died for that heart, knowing fully from the beginning that they would say no. It's more love than I have. I'm glad it's the same one that gave me the courage to stand up here tonight. Back to Lachish. Land of horses, harness the chariot, swift steeds. Chariots were basically the equivalent of tanks. Everything that they had, military-wise, every advantage, it was not going to be useful. But Lachish, being a military city, the reason why they hadn't fallen at the same time as the northern 10 tribes was because the Philistines basically, it was renamed Palestine as a mocking to the people of Israel. The Palestinians were basically just immigrants from Syria and Jordan and various other countries that squatted on the land until it was given to them back after World War II by the British Empire, that was now being a little bit more realistic on the ground that they could support. And in the end of all of this, the Philistines were the one compromise that basically the people, after Joshua had been conquering and taking out the giants, taking out the city of Jericho, Ai, every single victory that God gave him. After he died, the people grew complacent, and we left into the time of judges, where a hero had to be raised up to push the Philistines back, push the idols back, deal with the corruption in Israel. Oh, praise God, you freed us all, and then they sink back into it again. Same process with their kings, same process with human nature. God was patient. He's still using them today, which encourages me. If he can deal with Israel, knowing their history in the book of Numbers, that means I can probably still be useful despite my constant backsliding. It's wonderful to have a God that's not only loving, but he's patient. they wouldn't budge. They had built, David had established a military structure that would basically have, you could say, a spiritual border patrol, and say, you want to bring those idols in here, it's going to have to come on the other edge of the sword. But if you can look this up at home, we didn't have time to get illustrations and maps, but how the 13 tribes of Israel were organized, Manasseh having two different sections, north and south, on the east side of the Jordan River. Okay, it's not up there. Everything that they were given, it was all handed to them by lot, by just drawing straws, basically. And what the people of Israel had for themselves was Judah was given the capital. It wasn't conquered yet until the time of David, but they were given the central piece of where the Messiah would come. And God had given them all of this beautiful land. And there was one tribe just to the north of where the Philistine territories survived, that was named Dan. Dan was the first nation of tribe of Israel that fell into idolatry. And it was from there that all the other 10 tribes fell suit. And then it came into Judah, if not through anything but osmosis. And Lachish was the first city of compromise. One hole in the boat that sunk the whole ship. It took a while, but the breach couldn't be contained because it was just that serious. One compromise against the flesh, one compromise against against your sinful nature. You don't take the enemy as seriously as he's about to take you, it's not going to go anywhere. But you're willing to go exactly how far Joshua did in saying, down to the last man, we will fight, we will stand for God. Down to the seriousness that God told Samuel when he told them to deal with the Amalekites. He said, don't even spare the cattle. Oh, that's cruel. Is your God a supporter of genocide? No, because Saul spared one king, and that king had kids, and their kids had kids named Haman, and Haman almost single-handedly wiped out the Jewish nation by himself. Imagine if those people had been spared. God told those people, you have your chance, you target my people, you're messing with me. And just like when he's dealing with his children, the good news is he's going to leave a remnant. The Jewish people are still around today. But here's the other serious part, is that one compromise, and it almost cost the entire country. One compromise, and it can almost cost an entire life. One decision could mean the difference between your relationships today and the way that God can use you. Even one interaction of corruption is enough to stain a soul. But everything that God's putting you through now, you have to realize the end result is what the wise man looks for. God is the source of wisdom. He's the wellspring of truth. And everything that he has to offer you, it is good, even if it means pain now. Because just like when I started working and I started getting paychecks, it hurt to go into that, to transfer from my Toys R Us mentality of whenever my grandparents would give me something, it's just burning a hole in my pocket. I gotta get to the Lego aisle before I can't walk. It hurt. But now that I can invest in larger things, and now that I can start planning for things like a car, I'd say the sacrifice is a little bit worth it. The same mentality that we're meant to take in our lives today. Because nothing could be further from the truth. Our culture is fraught with it. It's going to be little to no compromise when it comes to allowing internet in our homes. You're going to have to keep those barriers up. And if one compromise sets, you're going to have to cut that thing off. But remember, it's more than worth it if it means the end is your soul. God wants to use you in ways that you cannot imagine. Look at how he's using me. I can't even believe I'm standing up here right now, and this is more than I deserve. I've made compromises that have cost me more than my share of callings, but God's still using me in spite of it. God's people have outright rejected him, and he's still saying, I have 144,000 people that's going to make the entire age of the church look like just a street side evangelist holding up a sign. God is so faithful. God is so loving. Everything that he has to offer your life, it is just beyond words. And the thing I'd say that Bo's taught me is that nothing speaks more. I could stand up here for 5 hours like Paul, and someone could fall from the barrier and I could raise him from the dead, and then they'll wish they were dead because I'll keep preaching. I could have every single opportunity to share with every single person on the planet. I could be an evangelist going down to China. I could be anything. But where God's called me to right now is to just live a life that honors him, and that speaks volumes more than the last 50 minutes ever could. Because believe me, in this culture and in this day, where our nation stands in the world's respect right now, where humanity stands in respect to the standard that God set for holiness a long time ago, we're a far way off. The world has grown very dark. But as I recall, the darker the room is, the more noticeable it is when one light is shining. Father, thank you for this time in your word. Thank you that even in spite of your correction, and if not outright, well, I don't want to say condemnation, but there is really no word for it, discipline of your people, even calling us on out to the floor in our lives, and that what we've done and all the decisions that we've made that separate us from you, all the things that we've chosen that just aren't wise and aren't according to your will, but are just a part of our fallen, sinful human nature. I just pray, God, that these words would rest on our hearts and remind us that even in spite of our constant failings, that you are a faithful God, that everything was nailed to the cross of Jesus Christ, and that that promise is just as true as the nation of Israel stands today. We can look to history, we can look to facts, but more importantly, we can look to the change in our own lives, Father. And we thank you for being so faithful. We thank you for using us in spite of our constant failure, but that even in spite of it, your love can overcome even the darkest world, that your love stood in the darkest world higher above anything, that no matter what high place we try and compete with you in our lives, that Calvary's cross still stands, and that's the one thing that will never come down in our hearts. Thank you for placing that foundation there and for giving us an opportunity to enjoy it and know that even when you correct us, that it's only proof more that you love us. In your name, amen.